Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 48. I'm recording it on Thursday, November 20th, 2008. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is Capitalism on Trial. This is a somewhat unusual topic for an investing podcast. But as I think about it, I actually think it's a topic that may be of some significance, and it may be one that needs to be explored in more depth than I'll be able to explore it in this podcast. Some of the ideas here may be sketchy because I've never written about this topic before and I've never recorded a podcast on it before. But as I think about it, I feel that it there's something there. It's helping me put different pieces together of things that are going on in our society today. Now, one of the things that's come up as a result of the elections here in the United States is the question. I don't want to get into politics. I don't do politics. This is, PassionSaving.com is a personal finance site. But politics, in some cases, starts to diverge into the investing area. And this past election was dominated by economic considerations. And now we're in the transition from a Republican administration to a Democratic administration. And that continues to be the case. Economics, the economic situation we're in a recession, but it's more than just an ordinary recession. There's a feeling that something has failed us, and that going ahead, things are going to be different. We don't know exactly how different, but I think there's a strong feeling among many people today that something has failed us, and things are going to be different going ahead. And just, the obvious example of this is that this huge bank bailout, that was controversial. It was supported by both Democrats and Republicans. It was supported by the Bush administration. It was supported by both presidential candidates. There were many voters who did not support it. It was not a popular bailout. And it goes against the premise of capitalism. The premise of capitalism is that business entities compete, and those that do well succeed, and those that do poorly fail. And the bailout, of course, I don't think anyone would dispute that the bailout runs counter to that. And now there's discussion of a bailout of the auto companies. And again, we have a situation where large corporate enterprises are being saved or may be saved by the taxpayers. And of course, all these questions come in of if you're going to save these large corporate entities, then don't we also have to save the employees of these entities, employees who are losing their jobs because of the recession, or workers who are losing their houses? There's even a phrase. There's a phrase that I believe it was a Democratic lawmaker used. I don't recall who, but someone referred to the New Deal. Perhaps it was just a columnist. I'm not sure. I believe it was a lawmaker. They were talking about the New Deal. And of course, that's a reference back to the New Deal legislation of Franklin Roosevelt, which came about, during the first Great Depression. Let's hope we're not heading into a second. But the New Deal, the concept there was that pure capitalism was being replaced. In the years before the New Deal, we had a much more of a pure capitalist economy. And the New Deal brought in things like Social Security, brought in a safety net to protect the people who could be hurt by pure capitalism, and also, I think it would be fair to say, to make capitalism livable. To make capitalism livable. In other words, the New Deal was not brought in to destroy capitalism. It was brought in to support it. It was in a sense anti-capitalist in that it was a step in the other direction. But the purpose was to moderate capitalism and therefore make capitalism last longer and bring us more good things. So, we've lived now for a good number of years under a modified form of capitalism, and there's a sense that we may be modifying it again. Perhaps that's too dramatic. Perhaps there are some people today just, getting too worked up about becoming too alarmist. But there certainly is a sense that that's a possibility. It's a possible road we are going down. And I'm not going to focus at all on the political aspects of that question, but I see a connection in our discussion to our discussions about how stock investing works. And I'd like to use this podcast to sketch out that connection. And I think it's potentially important. I think this podcast will be sketchy, but I think there are some significant ideas lurking under the surface here. Now, I'll start by saying that Robert Shiller has been proven right, and John Bogle has been proven wrong. There are no doubt people who will challenge that statement. I have no doubt whatsoever in my mind. There are people who will challenge that statement, but I think that's a fair statement. Robert Shiller, he's the author of Irrational Exuberance. Robert Shiller published his book in the year 2000. He's done research going back decades, showing that valuations affect long-term returns. John Bogle is the primary advocate of the alternate investing philosophy, passive investing, which says either that valuations don't affect long-term returns, or at least that there's no need to be concerned about it. There's no need to adjust your stock allocation in response to big changes in valuations. So we have two opposing schools of thought on how stock investing works, and I obviously am in the Shiller camp, although I admire much of Bogle's teachings, and I have no doubt that Robert Shiller does as well. But Robert Shiller has been proven right. Valuations do matter, and we're living through that today. We're living through what happens to people who ignore that reality. And John Bogle has been proven wrong. I wish that we could all just acknowledge that and stop the nonsense. Because once we acknowledge he's been proven wrong, we can go ahead and learn all sorts of exciting things. But as long as the debate remains stalled as to whether passive investing has failed or not, we all go around in circles. But I'll leave that. Let me leave that discussion aside so that I can focus on the point of this podcast. Something that hit me. There's. When I say that Shiller has been proven right, let me say something else as preface. I love Robert Shiller's book, Irrational Exuberance. In my view, it is the most important book on investing ever published. So it's a wonderful book. But I have made one criticism of the book in the past, and that is that Shiller, he does a fantastic job of describing how stock investing works. But he does very little in the way of giving investors advice on what to do. In other words, he doesn't do much in terms of saying, you should change your allocation, X amount at Y time. And I think it would be fair to describe the work that I have done in this field as being I essentially took Shiller's research and made it actionable for the middle-class investor. That's really what my calculators do. The calculators at PassionSaving.com. They take Shiller's PE10 tool, his valuation tool, and they say, if an investor believed that Shiller was right, how would that investor go about investing? And obviously the answer is he would change his allocation when prices got out of control, and he would use PE10 to learn how much the value proposition of stocks changes at various, you know, with changes in prices. So my work, what I try to do is take Shiller's understanding of how the market works and make it actionable. Give people actionable advice. All right. Now, there's a sense in which that aspect of the Shiller teaching has always sort of bothered me. That Shiller doesn't seem to view it as important to give people investing advice. He's, you know, his book is wonderful regardless, but it's always sort of gnawed at me. Why didn't he do that? Why didn't he do that? And I still think he should have done it, but something that's hitting me a little bit as I see the economic devastation that has resulted from following Bogle's understanding of how stock investing works, the passive investing model, is it's almost as if Shiller was coming at this from a very different place. And it's interesting to think about exactly where, you know, how is he different? How is his approach different? And why does he follow that different approach? And of course, one big difference is that Shiller is an academic and Bogle is, you know, was the head of the Vanguard fund group. So Bogle is in the stock selling industry. You know, for good or for ill, that's his job. His job is to sell stocks. That obviously influences the advice he gives. Shiller is an academic. So Shiller has he comes at it from a different viewpoint. But I'm thinking today that there's actually something more to it. Shiller, and of course it's influenced by the fact that he's an academic, perhaps he takes a broader view, but there's another way to describe the difference between where Shiller's coming from and where Bogle's coming from. And when I say Bogle, I don't mean just Bogle. I mean all advocates of passive investing. Passive investing is a very individualistic approach to understanding how investing works. I made this comparison, actually. In an earlier podcast, I compared the efficient market theory, which is the intellectual framework for passive investing, I compared that with the invisible hand, which is an understanding of how markets work, how capitalism works. And I think that's a very good, it's a very interesting comparison. And I think something that's going on is that the people who try to understand how investing works, who come at it from the investor side of things, let's call it, okay, whether they're in the stock selling industry or they're heavily invested in stocks, the investor side, as opposed to the public policy side. That's really what's going on in Shiller's book. He has a chapter at the end about what the investor should do. And the chapter, but it was a letdown to me because he doesn't say how you should change your allocation. He focuses on public policy issues, which in most investing literature that's considered beside the point. The point is, you know, how can I get ahead? How can I make more money? Me, 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 me. You know, it's selfish. Selfish. And Shiller doesn't do that. And I found that frustrating because I'm used to the selfish approach. And I'm like, wait a minute, where's the bottom line? Where's the practical stuff? Where's the actionable, you know, advice? Where's the me, me, me part of your book? And he leaves that out. Shiller is coming at this from a public policy, and you could say he's coming at it from a public policy standpoint. He's coming at it from a communitarian standpoint. He's not looking at stock investing. He's not trying to say, how can you, as the individual investor, do better? He's saying, how can we, as a community of investors do better. And that, of course, rings a chord with Rob Bennett. You know, anyone who's familiar with my writing knows that I talk about community all the time. So I've come to realize, really, just in the last few hours, frankly, as I started putting together some notes for this podcast, that Shiller is he's a communitarian. He's not just a valuations guy. He's a communitarian. And it's quite logical. It's quite understandable why one would lead to the other. Because when you look at valuations, what you are looking at are investor emotions. It's investor emotions that cause overvaluation and undervaluation, not rational economic changes. It's emotion. And where does emotion come from? It comes from humans. So Shiller, when I say he's a communitarian, what I'm sort of saying is he's a human. He's got a human focus. How is that different from Bogle and all other passive investing enthusiasts? Well, the passive investing enthusiast, it's not that they're not human, of course, and it's not that they're not writing for humans, but they're not writing for communities. They're writing for individuals. Their focus is not a communitarian focus. It's an individual focus. It's a me, me, me focus. How can you get ahead? Nothing wrong with it. I'm not criticizing any more than I'm criticizing capitalism. But I guess I am, you know, as a community, United States is a community. As a community, we are criticizing capitalism to a point. It's unclear how strong we are criticizing it, you know, how broadly one should interpret these election results. But we are finding fault with capitalism. We are saying capitalism let us down. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having a huge bank bailout. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about bailing out the automakers. We are questioning. We are in a process of questioning capitalism, which means we are in a process of questioning individualism, because capitalism is the individual focused way of running the economy. When things like Social Security, that's not individual oriented, that's community oriented. That's the community creates a pool of money and it helps the individual in need. So one could say, instead of saying, when I say Shiller is right and Bogle is wrong, you could interpret that as valuations do matter, passive investing has flunked. Passive investing has been discredited. But another way of looking at it would be to say the communitarian approach to understanding how markets work has won, at least temporarily. And the individualistic / capitalist approach to understanding how markets work has failed the test, at least temporarily, at least in this chapter of the story. I think that is an interesting way of looking at it, and it's a way of looking at it that may yield a good number of insights. And so it's Something that hits me right away when I start thinking along those lines is the big problem we've had in the retire early community and in the indexing discussion board communities is, I've mentioned this many times, but we've had a large number of people who have wanted to learn more about how the markets really work, how valuations affect long-term returns. You know, I think it's a majority. I think it's a big majority, 80% probably, that would like to have open discussions. And yet we've had this 20% that always destroys the discussions, is ruthlessly abusive. And the 20%, it's not a random group. It's the so-called leaders. It's always the leaders who are most abusive at every investing board I've been at, the quote-unquote leaders. And of course, that's odd. You wouldn't expect that. you would think that the leaders would be the most responsible people. The leaders would be the ones who would have the greatest concern that the community be a success. And they would be inviting in different viewpoints. They wouldn't want to be trying to shut down different viewpoints. They wouldn't be abusive, certainly. But yet we've seen this again and again and again. We've seen it too many times to think that it's an accident, that it's a coincidence. Why are the leaders of our communities, the most abusive posters in our communities. It's because the leaders, this is obvious, it's because the leaders, the quote-unquote leaders, are the ones with the most at risk. They are threatened by new ideas. They rose to their so-called positions of leadership during a time when the passive investing model was king of the hill. It was unquestioned during the bull market. And so when they see historical data showing that passive investing doesn't add up, they say, wait a minute, my position here is under, it's under threat. I need to stomp this out. So you have this backwards sort of phenomenon where at the grassroots level, you've got lots of people interested in having discussions, but the leadership level is dead set against it. And because they are leaders, they have power that regular community members would not have. So for example, if the two leaders, the two most abusive have been, the two leaders of the abusive camps are Mel Lindauer and John Graney. If those two individuals, you know, had not been leaders in their communities, they would have been removed. I'm certain of it. But the site owners were reluctant to remove individuals who were generally recognized as leaders in their community. I think it's absolutely safe to say that that's a big factor in the troubles we've experienced. All right. There's a general phenomenon going on there. It's not just a discussion board community phenomenon. The idea that valuations affect long-term returns and that it's necessary to change your allocation when valuations get out of hand, it's not a new idea. Rob Bennett didn't come up with that idea. It's obviously in Shiller's book, and it obviously was present before Shiller wrote his book. So why has that idea been banned? Why is that idea so taboo? I think it's taboo because, in a general sense, it threatens people who invest under an individualistic approach to understanding how markets work. And most of us aren't in that camp. The group that I call the normals, these are just your normal middle class investor. They don't study investing. What most of us do is we hear what the experts say and we go along with that, and we don't really know why they say it. This is something Shiller examines in the book, how people come to their decisions about how to invest. They don't study everything. They hear the safe withdrawal rate's 4%. They hear it from five different people. They assume it must be true. They don't check the study. They don't check the methodology. So you have this big group of people who, of course, are now suffering, you know, horrible financial setbacks. And in theory, you would think this group of people would be angry. This group of people would insist that advisors start giving them better information. But they almost don't know where to start. They see this thing happening to them and they don't know why it's happening. But the group that's positioned to know what's happening, the so-called leaders, or the experts, let's say, the experts are very reluctant to open up our understanding of how investing works to new ideas, because they, like the goon posters at the discussion boards, they see themselves as having achieved some sort of status, and that status is threatened by new ideas. You know, they've been giving out this advice that passive investing works for two or three decades, and they don't like the idea of turning back and changing that and admitting they were wrong. So you've got a conflict here between the community and the individuals. And it's parallel in many ways to the conflict between, capitalism and socialism. You know, no one is saying we're going to move to a purely socialist economy any more than we're going to move to a purely capitalist economy. But I do think the debate that's going on today is, are we going to move significantly in the direction of of a greater measure of socialism, as we certainly did in the New Deal. And that was considered a success. And there are many people thinking now, with people losing their jobs, losing their houses, with companies failing, banks failing, stock market failing, we may be, you know, it may be too dramatic to call this a new deal. But there are people thinking along those lines. And the public, the general public, does not seem excessively alarmed about it. The general public seems to feel, this capitalism thing hasn't worked out quite as it was promised. Now, again, I don't want to get into the political side of it, but I see a parallel to the passive investing question. The passive investing model has not worked out as promised. And that, too, may be under question, I hope. Of course, on that one, I have strong opinions. I believe that the passive investing has failed us. I believe it's dangerous. I believe it's irresponsible. But of course, it helps in trying to overcome it. It helps to try to understand, you know, why do people support passive investing? Why do people even like it? And a big part of what's going on is that it is a way of thought, and it's a way of thought where some people sort of rose to prominence or rose to wealth. They had successes, and they don't want to acknowledge that those days are over. And yet the broad majority needs to learn about these things, and the broad majority is sort of shut out. In other words, in our discussions of investing, how often do we really hear from the average investor? Not at all often. What we hear are a sliver of the investing population totally dominates debate. You know, just think about, I think about it sometimes in terms of, how you build a website. And of course, people have to enter search terms to get to a website. Well, I found when I posted on discussion boards about rational investing or valuation-informed indexing, there was always huge interest in every board I've ever posted at. So I believe that's probably true across the board, that if these ideas were exposed nationally, there would be millions of people interested in them. But the people who are interested tend to be your average investor, not an investor who spends all his time thinking about investing, not a leader investor, just an average person. The leader investors are the ones who plug search terms into Google search engine. The average people don't plug those search terms. They sort of, they might go to Motley Fool, or they might go to Morningstar, they might learn something from participating in a discussion board, but they're not sufficiently motivated to look for new ideas. They don't necessarily even understand how passive investing is supposed to work. I know that they don't understand how the old school safe withdrawal rate studies work. I've seen much evidence of that. So I think there's a parallel phenomenon going on here, and I want to read a little bit from Shiller's chapter where he gives his recommendations. As I say, they are not, they're more public policy recommendations than they are individual investor recommendations. But they take this community-oriented approach over an individual approach. So it may be, I guess what I'm trying to say here is, we may be moving not only towards an approach to investing that takes valuations into consideration. I think we're moving towards an approach to investing that is more community-oriented than the discredited passive investing model. And I think properly so, because what happens in the stock market affects us all, as we see with this economic turmoil we're living through. This economic turmoil was brought on largely, not entirely, but largely by the excesses of the passive investing age. Passive investing encouraged people to wildly overinvest in stocks. That caused the stock market to go to triple its fair value. And for the market to continue to function, prices have to come down, prices have to crash. But the crash took $8 trillion of wealth. out of the pockets of middle-class investors in the past year. And that sucking out of wealth has caused a recession. It's caused great economic turmoil. So should we have a is it right to have a situation where these decisions about how investing works are made by a small percentage of the population, 5% or 10% who study investing all the time, and the experts and the people in the stock selling industry? Or should our understanding of how investing works be more of a general question where everyone participates because everyone's affected by the consequences of getting it wrong? When the stock market fails, we all suffer. Even those who aren't invested in stocks suffer. If we have an economic recession or an economic depression, we all suffer. So we all should be involved in decisions and in the decision making process as to our decisions about how investing works and our decisions about what sorts of investing discussions are to be permitted in the public square. Now, here are some words from Robert Shiller's book. This is from chapter 11. Speculative Volatility in a Free Society is the name of the chapter. The market level, he says, the high recent valuations in the stock market have come about for no good reasons. The market level does not, as so many imagine, represent the consensus judgment of experts who have carefully weighed the long-term evidence. The market is high because of the combined effect of indifferent thinking by millions of people, very few of whom feel the need to perform careful research on the long-term investment value of the aggregate stock market, and who are motivated substantially by their emotions, random attentions, and perceptions of conventional wisdom. That's a great two sentences. I think that sums things up well, and there's an implication there that Shiller is obviously saying he doesn't like this state of affairs, and he's suggesting that stock market prices we need to have other people, other influences on stock market prices, not just, you know, these sort of random emotions. You know, people get pumped up by marketing slogans from the stock selling industry, and that causes huge overvaluation, and that causes economic disaster. This isn't something where people just get to invest as they please. See, that's the individual/capitalistic model. Everyone should do as they please, and everything works out in the end. And I am a capitalist. Please understand, I'm not finding fault in a general way with that idea, but there are limits. And I think we've crossed the limits. I think when we made it taboo to report the safe withdrawal rate accurately, we crossed a line. Passive investing went too far. Capitalism went too far. The individualistic approach went too far. And the community needs to rise up and start insisting on some influence on how these sorts of questions will be discussed and resolved, because we're all in the same boat. It's not just people with money in the market who have a right to a say in how the market is valued. I'm not talking about the government stepping in and changing the market value, but I am talking about people of influence taking steps to better educate investors about the realities, to not let the stock selling industry totally dominate what we are told about how investing works. We need Consumer Reports type of entities stepping in and saying, no. The word safe has a meaning, and people have a right to understand when they build a retirement plan, they have a right to know the realities of what the historical data really says. Here's another sentence from Shiller. It is a serious mistake for public figures to acquiesce in the stock market valuations we have seen recently, to remain silent about the implications of such high valuations, and to leave all commentary to the market analysts who specialize in the nearly impossible task of forecasting the market over the short term, and who share interest with investment banks or brokerage firms. The valuation of the stock market is an important national, indeed international, issue. All of our plans for the future as individuals and as a society hinge on our perceived wealth, and plans can be thrown into disarray if much of the wealth evaporates tomorrow. Those are important words. I'm not going to add any commentary, but that says it. That says it. And he points out that some may be reluctant to speak because they're not certain that they're right about everything. And he says, but an observer who remains silent about the unjustifiably high values because he or she could be wrong about the outlook is no better than a doctor who, having diagnosed high blood pressure in a patient, says nothing because the patient might be lucky and show no ill effects. I agree. People need to stick their necks out a little bit. And I don't know how many times I've pointed out that the safe withdrawal rate in the old school studies is calculated inaccurately, and people have said, oh, it might work. There's a chance. 4% might work. As if that were an answer to the problem of reporting that withdrawal rate is safe, when it is, in fact, at high valuation levels, it's a high-risk withdrawal rate. Now, there's a section here on what should investors do now. And this is a sentence that always hit me. He says, if over some interval in the first decade or so of the 21st century, the U.S. stock market is going to follow an uneven course down, as well it might, back, let us say, to its levels in the mid-90s or even lower, then individuals, foundations, college endowments, and other beneficiaries of the market are going to find themselves poorer in the aggregate by trillions of dollars. The real losses could be comparable to the total destruction of all the schools in the country, or all the farms in the country, or possibly even all the homes in the country. Well, we're living through that today. In the past 15 months, we've seen a loss $8 trillion. John Bogle himself commented on that recently. John Bogle said that the market today is valuing U.S. business at $8 trillion less than it valued it a year ago. And Bogle said that that's crazy. And he's right. But he failed to draw the necessary conclusion, which is that a market that changed its value of U.S. business by $8 trillion is not an efficient market. I repeat, not an efficient market. Passive investing doesn't work if there's not an efficient market. We need people speaking up. If we're going to suffer losses equal to the destruction of all the schools in the country, or all the farms in the country, or possibly all the homes in the country, we all should have a say. Not just people who have millions in the market. Not just people who sell stocks for a living. This is a public policy issue. That's what Shiller's saying. And the more I think about it, the more I say he's right. I missed this. I read this book, I think, two times, and a third time I skimmed through it, and I missed it. And now that we're living through it, I see it. Shiller is right on. He's right on. Now, he makes a point here that you know, he's talking about, this is where he gets the closest to talking about actionable information. What should the investor do? And he says there's a fundamental difficulty with advising individuals to get out of the stock market. If such advice were suddenly taken by large numbers, it would cause an immediate drop in the level of the market. In fact, we cannot all get out of the market. We can only sell our shares to someone else. Somebody must be left holding the outstanding shares. As a group, those unfortunate people who bought in at the market high have already made their mistake. We cannot correct it for them as a group after the fact. That's the zero-sum idea. Stock investing is a zero-sum game, and it's important. I don't think it's true across the board that learning how to invest effectively is a zero-sum game. But there is a sense in which it is true, and Shiller's pointing that out here, and I don't think he thinks it's true, that's a zero-sum game across the board. But he's making an important point, because when you try to explain to people why it's critical that Investors lower their stock allocations at times of insane prices. You'll often get this response from passive investing enthusiasts. They'll say, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, if someone sells, someone else buys. If someone else buys, someone else sells. There's this indifference. And underneath what's going on is there's an indifference to what happens to us as a community. And that indifference is wrong. It's wrong. It's morally wrong. I think it's also intellectually wrong. It's morally wrong because there's great human suffering that comes about as a result of this indifference. But it's intellectually wrong because it's not even true that when we destroy ourselves as a society, we all suffer the pains. You can't just say, oh, I'm above it. You know, I made mine. I made mine, bud. I don't need to worry about the people who suffer busted retirements. That's their problem. I made mine. That doesn't work. If we suffer a depression, it's not just going to be the people who mistakenly relied on the old school safe withdrawal rate studies who are going to suffer pain. We're all going to suffer pain. We're all in this boat together. It's a community. Investing is a community act to a large extent. Not entirely so. Not any more than the economy should entirely be controlled by the community. But the community should have a say. The community should have a seat at the table. The community should have influence because the entire community is affected by bad decisions. And I think it's fair to say at this point that the passive investing enthusiasts have made many, many, many bad decisions. Irresponsible decisions. Narrow-minded decisions. Now here's a section where this is something that really needs. Let me see if I can find the right section. There's a section where he talks about the. Now I seem to have lost it, but there's a section where he talks about how the pain that is felt as a result of these price bubbles. Yes, here it is. But one could say that such a fall would really be harmless. Since nothing is physically destroyed by a fall in stock market values, it is only a change on paper and in our minds. Boy, doesn't that sound like a passive investor? One could say that if the market were to fall by half, it would only bring us back to where we were a few years ago in terms of market value. But there is the problem that the loss will not be borne equally. Some who rode the market up to new prosperity will have lightened up on their stock holdings and will keep their gains. Others will have recently entered the market and will take only the losses. Thus, a substantial fall in the market would leave some people really poor while leaving others very rich. Isn't that the truth? I'll follow my usual practice of taking an idea that Shiller puts forward and sort of translating it into the investing advice type of presentation. Young people were done great harm by these insanely high prices. Say an investor, I don't know when most people have money to start investing, say it's at age 30, and they basically have from age 30 to age 65 to accumulate the assets needed for retirement. Say that someone got to age 30 in the year 2000. And they started putting their money in, through a 401k, they started just putting money in every couple of weeks from their paycheck. They've obviously had no gains. The stock market didn't increase at all from 2000 through 2007, and then we've had a 45% drop in the past 12 months. So these people have losses instead of gains. Now, when those people... If those people are going to retire on time, they need to have gains because that's how compounding comes into effect. But they're not going to have compounding, are they? And there's the potential of another 50% drop. We don't know that that's going to happen, but it could happen. And that could drag on for another 5, 6, 7 years. These people are being put deep in a hole. And these people were told by the passive investing enthusiast that they should be going heavily into stocks despite the insane prices. I never agreed with that advice. I've spoken out against it on many occasions. The standard advice, the conventional advice is only if you're near retirement age should you be more cautious. If you're young, it should all go into stocks because it's going to pay off in the long run. Well, how long is it going to take to pay off? Think how far those people are in a hole today, how much farther they could be in a hole 5 years from now. Those people should have been protecting their assets. And the true reality is, as a community, we never should have allowed prices to get so high. That's the point. We never should have allowed prices to get so high. It was a disgraceful, irresponsible act by the investing community as a whole. I would go farther than that. It's not just the investing community that was irresponsible. It's the entire nation. Even those who don't invest in stocks should have spoken up. And Shiller, boy, he nailed it. He nailed it in that sentence where he said responsible leaders need to speak up about this sort of thing. I have not seen that policy recommendation discussed. It is a serious mistake for public figures to acquiesce in the stock market valuations we have seen recently. Wow. I haven't seen that discussed. That should be a cover article, not only in Money Magazine. It should be a cover article in Money Magazine. It should also be a cover article in Time Magazine. That's a public policy issue. Why do we allow ourselves to be put in the sort of circumstances we are in today? If we're going to get ourselves out of this hole, we need to be serious about how we got in the hole. And we got in the hole by allowing stock prices to go to insane levels. And the way they got to insane levels is by a failure. A failure of our leaders, a failure of us, a failure of the citizens. One, to appreciate the problem. We obviously didn't do this deliberately. We did not appreciate the problem. And two, to fail to act. Of course, and of course, the fact that we didn't appreciate it limited our ability to act. But we're not going to come to appreciate it until we start to make some changes in what can be spoken about in debates on investing. We need to make some changes, people. We need to make some changes in how we discuss investing topics. It's not only people who have lots of money in the market who are affected by price crashes. The auto companies are failing. The banks are failing. People are being thrown out of their houses. Some of those people had money in stocks, some didn't. Are people going to say, well, they deserved it? They deserved it? There's, of course, an element of personal responsibility. There's no question. But there's also an element here of community irresponsibility. When you allow the stock market to get to 3 times its fair value, that is an act of brazen irresponsibility. When you allow people in the stock selling industry to tell us that the safe withdrawal rate is a constant number, when any high school student should be able to understand that showing that a 4% withdrawal produced bone-crushing losses in every occasion in which it's been tried from high valuations does not show that that withdrawal rate is 100% safe, as is argued in one of the old school studies. Capitalism on trial. Passive investing on trial. There are so many I'm just going to have to list them briefly, but there are so many implications from thinking about investing in this way. Thinking about investing, the point here is that it's not just the individual investor who gets hurt when valuations are ignored. Passive investing is a know-nothing approach to investing. Even some of the passive investing enthusiasts call it that. They say, I'm a know-nothing investor. Know-nothingism hurts us all because it hurts our ability to learn. Know-nothing investing hurts us all. The risk for retirees is obviously a community concern. To have people, you know, are we really going to say, in all likelihood, we are going to see millions of busted retirements because of the demonstrably false claims in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies? When those people are thrown out on the street, you know what the answer you get from the passive investing enthusiast is to that problem? They say, well, they could tighten their belts. They could tighten their belts. Are we going to throw these people out on the street as a community, as a nation, and we're going to say, oh, they should have known to tighten their belts? We all have a responsibility for what is taught about retirement planning. Retirement, you know, that's why we have Social Security. There's an understanding as a community that we have a responsibility to the elderly. They're vulnerable. They're an economically vulnerable class because they're too aged to continue to work and bring in an income. But that doesn't stop when we create a Social Security program. That responsibility is there when some individual puts forward a study that these people are using to plan their retirements. Those studies should have to meet certain standards. I'm not recommending government regulation, although some may end up calling for it. It wouldn't shock me. But I do believe as a community, we all have an obligation to speak out about that sort of thing, to challenge it. The economy, of course. The economy is the biggest one. You know, a lot of times when you read the investing literature, you would think it's always recessions that cause drops in stock prices. Is that true? I don't think it's true. There's no question but that there's some correlation there, that when the economy does poorly, stock prices go down. But the correlation goes the other way just as often, I think more often. High stock prices cause stock crashes, and stock crashes are an evaporation of wealth. An evaporation of wealth causes recessions. So irresponsible investing causes recessions. That can be checked. That can be checked in the historical record, and you will find a correlation. Whenever stocks go to insane price levels, in the aftermath, there are economic hard times. We all should be concerned about that. Startup businesses fail because of passive investing, passive/emotional investing ideas. When the stock selling industry tells us, don't worry about price, no problem. Don't worry. It's all going to be different this time. No one will suffer this time. Somehow we'll figure it out. Magic pixie dust will save everything. When that message becomes popular, people who start businesses see them fail. We think of it as two different worlds, but it's not two different worlds. The stock market is a big deal. It's not just individuals trying to score some money who invest in stocks. We invest in stocks as a people. And the stock market influences the world around us. So all of us should have a say in what sort of investing advice is permitted and what sort of investing advice we are able to hear. Fraud. You know, we've read about fraud. in recent years? Fraud increases when stock prices get out of hand. Why? Because there's so much phony money sloshing around. We have checks and balances in our society. And these checks and balances, part of the purpose is to put a brake on fraud. But when there's, $8 trillion of phony money floating around, as there was a year ago, we're now at fair value, and we're $8 trillion less than we were a year ago, so that $8 trillion was funny money. Well, who's going to complain if, everyone takes their little piece of it? This guy scratches this guy's back, and the other guy scratches him back. And they all take $100,000 each. Who's going to complain? But when the fall comes, who takes the hit? These are the sorts of questions that we're debating as a society today, because of this market crash, the passive investing crash of 2008. Effective financial planning is made impossible. I've talked about this on an earlier podcast, but how can anyone plan a retirement when they don't know how much money they have? How can you know when there's one number at the bottom of your portfolio statement, but there's no adjustment for valuation in that number? So the number's not stable. It's funny money. It's cotton candy. But no one knows how much is cotton candy. Some of it is real. How's anyone to know how much if it's not reported? If we don't, as a public policy matter, make it a practice to report the realities. The saving problem is worsened. One of the big problems we have, I saw an article, I think it was just this morning, or it might have been yesterday, it was something like, I can't think of the guy's name now who did the article, but he's on Market Watch, Paul somebody, I can't think of his last name. But, he had 30 reasons why we're, I don't know, was it why we're heading into a depression? I hope not, but I think it was. And then there was another article similar to that where the guy was saying, I think it was in Forbes, and he was saying why consumers, are going to keep cutting back. And of course, when consumers cut back, that's what makes the recession harder. But one of the reasons consumers are cutting back is that we don't have enough savings. Well, guess what? It's human nature to want to, in this consumer wonderland of ours, there are thousands of wonderful things to buy, and we all want to buy them. It's perfectly natural, perfectly healthy, but we have to restrain ourselves. And what people do is they engage in some mental accounting, and they say, well, my house went up by $100,000 this year. I can afford to spend $10,000, on a vacation. Or they say, my stock funds went up $50,000 this year. I can afford to spend $5,000 extra on a car. I can afford some of the extras. The leather seats or whatever it is. That's how people make their decisions. But when we allow prices to go where we allowed them to go in the 1990s, all of those decisions are slanted in the wrong direction. No one knows how much money they think they, how much of the money they think they have is real. So the point here is, we need to broaden this debate. We need to broaden this debate. There was a wonderful quote. I did a podcast a little while ago called Greenspan's Mistake. And it was this article in the New York Times by David Brooks called The Behavioral Revolution. And he was speaking about how, he came, I don't think he had the words passive investing has failed, but I reading between the lines, he was basically saying our understanding of how stock investing works has failed. And he was saying that the behaviorists are the ones who are the future of investing. And Robert Shiller is a behaviorist. He's in the behavioral finance school, as am I. And we need to give these people, the behavioral finance people, much more influence, much more of a say, because their voices are drowned out. Their arguments are strong can be, rock solid. The passive investing arguments are weak as weak can be, but the passive investors' enthusiasts, the passive investing dogmatists have power. They have power because they appeal to this selfish instinct, you know, which is part of human nature too. But that's where their power is coming from. So when you try to raise the question that, hey, you know, maybe this value, maybe ignoring valuations isn't such a hot idea, they say, get away, buddy, I got mine. I'll take care of myself. I don't need your advice. And they shout. But we all are affected by their mismanagement and by their lack of understanding of how investing works in the real world. There were 525 comments, I believe, to that article. I couldn't even read them all. I read a good number of them in a follow-up podcast. But the last one said, let's hope this is the beginning of a national debate on these questions. That's what we need. And part of that debate has to be, you know, do valuations affect long-term returns? It's a silly question. The answer to it is so obvious. It's a silly question. But it needs to be the first question in the debate. And then the second question is, given that it's universally understood that valuations affect long-term returns, should we start including valuations in our analysis, in our investing analysis? Should people be told that when you look at valuations, the safe withdrawal rate sure ain't always 4%. It's sometimes as low as 2% and sometimes as high as 9%. Should people be told these things? Should people be told that the efficient market theory has been discredited by research dating back two decades? Should people be told that stocks don't provide the same long-term value proposition when prices are at insanely dangerous levels as they do when prices are at reasonable levels? I think people should be told this. And I don't think they should be told solely because they need to know it as individuals. They should be told it for that reason, to be sure. But they should also be told it because it affects the entire society to get these things wrong. Robert Shiller is right. I'm going to read his wonderful sentence, if I can find it, one more time. Then I will close out. Robert Shiller says in his book, Irrational Exuberance, published in the year 2000, it's available in public libraries everywhere. The passive investing enthusiasts have certainly had time to check it out. It is a serious mistake for public figures to acquiesce in the stock market valuations we have seen recently. We are living today the sad consequences of the failure of our leaders to take Robert Shiller's advice seriously. Good luck with your investing strategy. Take care.